and gardening supplies, the expected tools, and an alcove for the washer, dryer, and a big steel sink. No one has said anything about taking my car anywhere. I look accusingly at Berger, and am rocked by instant distrust. But either she is quite an actor, or she has no clue. I walk out into the middle of the garage and look around, as if I might find something that will tell me what has happened to my car. I tell Berger my black Mercedes sedan was here last Saturday, the day I moved to Anna's. I haven't seen the car since. I haven't been here since. But you have, I add. Was my car here when you were here last? How many times have you been here? I go ahead and ask her that. She is walking around, too. She squats before the garage door and examines scrapes on the rubber strip where we believe Sean Dunn used some type of tool to pry the door up. Could you open the door, please? Berger is grim. I press a button on the wall and the door loudly rolls up. The temperature inside the garage instantly drops. No, your car wasn't here when I was. Berger straightens up. I've never seen it. In light of circumstances, I suspect you do know where it is, she adds. The night fills the large empty space and I walk over to where Berger is standing. Probably impounded, I say. Jesus Christ. She nods. We'll get to the bottom of it. She turns to me, and there is something in her eyes I've never before seen. Doubt. Berger is uneasy. Maybe it is wishful thinking on my part, but I sense she feels bad for me. So now what? I mutter, looking around my garage as if I have never seen it before. What am I supposed to drive? Your alarm went off around 11 o'clock Friday night. Berger is all business again. She is firm and no-nonsense again. She returns to our mission of retracing Sean Dunn's steps. The cops arrive. You take them in here and find the door open about 8 inches. Obviously, she has seen the incident report of the attempted breaking and entering. It was snowing and you found footprints on the other side of the door. She steps outside and I follow. The footprints were covered with a dusting of snow, but you could tell they led around the side of the house up to the street. We stand on my driveway in the raw air, both of us without coats. I stare up at the murky sky, and a few flakes of snow coldly touch my face. It has started again. Winter has become a hemophiliac. It can't seem to stop precipitating. Lights from my neighbor's house shine through magnolias and bare trees, and I wonder how much peace of mind the people of Lock Green have left. Sean Dunn has tainted life for them, too. I wouldn't be surprised if some people move. Can you remember where the footprints were? Berger asks. I show her. I follow my driveway around the side of the house and cut through the yard, straight out to the street. Which way did he go? Berger looks up and down the dark, empty street. Don't know, I reply. The snow was churned up and it was snowing again. We couldn't tell which way he went. But I didn't stay out here looking either. I guess you'll have to ask the police. I think about Marino. I wish he would hurry up and get here, and I am reminded of why I called him. Fear and bewilderment crackle up my spine. I look around at my neighbors' houses. I have learned to read where I live, and can tell, by windows lit up, by cars in the driveway and newspaper deliveries, when people are home, which really isn't often. So much of the population here is retired and wintering in Florida, and spending hot summer months on the water somewhere. It occurs to me that I have never really had friends in my neighborhood, only people who wave when we pass each other in our cars. Berger walks back toward the garage, hugging herself to keep warm, the moisture in her breath freezing and puffing out white. I remember Lucy as a child coming to visit from Miami. Her only exposure to the cold was Richmond, and she would roll up notebook paper and stand out on the patio, pretending to smoke, tapping imaginary ashes, not knowing I was watching through a window. Let's back up, Berger is saying as she walks, to Monday, December 6th, the day the body was found in the container at the Richmond port, the body that we believe was Thomas Sean Dunn, allegedly murdered by his brother Jean-Baptiste. Tell me exactly what happened that Monday. I was notified about the body, I begin. By whom? Marino. Then minutes later my deputy chief Jack Fielding called. I said I would respond to the scene, I begin. But you didn't have to, she interrupts. You're the chief. We have a stinky, nasty, decomposing body on an unseasonably warm morning. You could have let, Fielding or whoever respond.
I could have.
Why didn't you?
It was clearly going to be a complicated case. The ship was out of Belgium, and we had to entertain the possibility that the body originated in Belgium, thus adding international difficulties. I tend to take the hard cases, the ones that will get a lot of publicity.
Because you like the publicity?
Because I don't like it.
We are inside my garage now, and both of us are thoroughly chilled. I shut the door.
And maybe you wanted to take this case because you'd had an upsetting morning?
Berger walks over to the large cedar locker.
You mind?
I tell her to help herself, as I marvel again at the details she seems to know about me.
Black Monday.
That morning, Senator Frank Lord, chairman of the Judiciary Committee and an old, dear friend, came to see me. In his possession was a letter Benton had written to me. I knew nothing about this letter. It would never occur to me that while Benton was on vacation at Lake Michigan some years ago, he had written me a letter and instructed Senator Lord to give it to me should he, Benton, die. I remember recognizing the penmanship when Senator Lord delivered the letter to me. I will never forget the shock. I was devastated. Grief finally caught up with me and seized my soul, and this was precisely what Benton had intended. He was the brilliant profiler to the end. He knew exactly how I would react should something happen to him, and he was forcing me out of my workaholic denial.
How do you know about the letter?
I numbly ask Berger. She is looking inside the locker at jumpsuits, rubber boots, waders, heavy leather gloves, long underwear, socks, tennis shoes.
Please bear with me, she says almost gently.
Just answer my questions for now. I'll answer yours later.
Later isn't good enough.
Why does the letter matter?
I'm not sure, but let's start with state of mind.
She lets that sink in. My state of mind is the bullseye of Caggiano's target should I end up in New York. More immediately, it is what everyone else seems to be questioning.
Let's assume if I know something, the opposing counsel does too, she adds.
I nod.
You get this letter out of the blue, from Benton.
She pauses, and emotion flickers across her face.
Let me just say, she looks away from me.
That would have undone me, too, totally.
I'm sorry for what you've been through,
she meets my eyes.
Another ploy to make me trust her? Bond with her?
Benton is reminding you a year after his death that you've probably not dealt with his loss. You've run like hell from the pain.
You can't have seen the letter.
I'm stunned and outraged.
It's locked in a safe. How do you know what it says?
You showed it to other people, she reasonably replies.
I realize, with the little bit of objectivity I have left, that if Berger hasn't talked to everyone around me, including Lucy and Marino, she will. It is her duty. She would be foolish and negligent if she didn't.
December the 6th, she resumes. He wrote the letter on December the 6th, 1996, and instructed Senator Lord to deliver it to you on December the 6th, following Benton's death.
Why was that date special to Benton?
I hesitate.
Thick skin, Kay, she reminds me. Thick skin.
I don't know the significance of December the 6th exactly, except Benton mentioned in the letter that he knew Christmas is hard for me, he reply. He wanted me to get the letter close to Christmas.
Christmas is hard for you?
Isn't it hard for everybody?
Berger is silent. Then she asks, when did your intimate relationship with him begin?
In the fall, years ago.
Okay, in the fall, years ago. That's when you began your sexual relationship with him.
She says this as if I am avoiding reality.
When he was still married, when your affair with him began.
That's right.
Okay. This past December the 6th, You get the letter and later that morning responded to the scene at the Richmond port. Then you came back here. Tell me exactly what your routine is when you come straight home from a crime scene. My scene clothes were double-bagged in the trunk of my car, I explain. A jumpsuit and tennis shoes. I keep staring at the empty space where my car should be. The jumpsuit went into the washing machine, the shoes into a sink of scalding water with disinfectant. I show her the shoes. They are still parked on the shelf where I left them to dry more than 2 weeks ago. Then, Berger walks over to the washing machine and dryer. Then I stripped, I tell her. I took off everything and put it in the washing machine, started it up, and went inside the house. Naked, yes. I went back to my bedroom, to the shower, without stopping. That's how I disinfect if I come straight home from a scene, I conclude. Berger is fascinated. She has a theory going, and whatever it is, I am feeling increasingly uncomfortable and exposed. I just wonder, she muses. Just wonder if he somehow knew. Somehow knew? And I really would like to go inside, if it's all right with you, I say. I'm freezing. Somehow knew your routine, she persists. If he was interested in your garage because of your routine, it was more than setting off the alarm. Maybe he really was trying to get in. The garage is where you take off your death clothes. In this instance, clothes sullied by a death he caused. You were nude and vulnerable, even if ever so briefly. She follows me back inside, and I shut the mudroom door behind us. He might have a real sexual fantasy about that. I can't see how he could know a damn thing about my routine. I resist her hypothesis. He didn't witness what I did that day. She raises an eyebrow as she looks at me. Can you say that as fact? Any possibility he followed you home? We know he was at the port at some point because that's how he got to Richmond, aboard the Sirius, where he'd covered himself with a white uniform, shaved visible areas of his body, and stayed in the galley most of the time, working as the cook and keeping to himself. Isn't that the theory? I certainly don't buy what he said when I interviewed him, that he stole a passport and wallet and flew coach. It's a theory that he arrived at the same time his brother's body showed up, I reply. So Jean-Baptiste, caring guy that he is, probably hung around in the ship and watched all you people scurrying around when the body was found. Greatest show on earth. These assholes love to watch us work their crimes. How could he have followed me? I get back to that outrageous thought. How? He had a car? Maybe he did, she says. I'm getting around to entertaining the possibility that Shandun wasn't the lone, wretched creature who just happened upon your city because it was convenient or even random. I'm no longer sure what his connections are, and I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps he might have been part of a grander scheme that has to do with the family business. Perhaps even with Bray herself, since she clearly was involved in an underworld of crime. And now we have other murders, one of the victims clearly involved in organized crime. An assassin, and an undercover FBI agent working a gun-smuggling case, and the hares at the campground that might be Shandun's. This is all adding up to something more than a man who killed his brother, took his place on a ship bound for Richmond, all to get out of Paris because his nasty little habit of murdering and mutilating women was becoming increasingly inconvenient to his powerful criminal family. Then he starts killing here because he can't control himself? Well, Berger leans against the kitchen counter. There are just too many coincidences. And how did he get to the campground if he didn't have a car? Assuming those hares turn out to be his, she repeats. I sit down at the table. There are no windows inside my garage, but there are small windows in the garage door. I consider the possibility that Shandun did follow me home and peeped through the garage door at me while I was cleaning up and undressing. Maybe he had help finding the abandoned house on the river, too. Maybe Berger is right. Maybe he isn't alone and never has been. It is almost midnight, almost Christmas, and Marino still isn't here, and Berger's demeanor tells me she could keep going until dawn. Alarm goes off, she resumes. Cops come and go. You return to the great room. She motions me to follow her there. You're sitting where?
On the sofa.
Right. TV on, going through bills, and around midnight, what?
There's a knock on the front door, I reply.
Describe the knock.
A rapping with something hard.
I try to remember every detail.
Like a flashlight or tactical baton, the way police knock.
I get up and ask who's there. Or I think I ask.
I'm not sure, but a male voice identifies himself as police. He says a prowler has been spotted on my property and asks if everything's okay.
And that makes sense because we know a prowler was there about an hour earlier when someone tried to force open your garage door.
Exactly. I nod. I turn off the alarm and open the door, and he is there.
I add, as if I am talking about nothing more threatening than trick-or-treaters.
Show me, Berger says.
I walk through the great room, past the dining room, and to the entrance hall. I open the door, and just the act of recreating a scenario that almost cost me my life causes a visceral reaction. I feel sick. My hands begin to tremble.
My front porch light is still out because the police removed the bulb and fixture and submitted them to the labs to be processed for fingerprints. No one has replaced them. Exposed wires dangle from the porch ceiling. Berger is waiting patiently for me to continue.
He rushes inside, I say, and back kicks the door shut behind him.
I shut the door.
He has this black coat and he tries to put it over my head.
Coat on or off when he came in?
On. He was grabbing it off as he came through the door.
I'm standing still.
And he tried to touch me.
Tried to touch you? Berger frowns.
With the chipping hammer?
With his hand. He reached out his hand and touched my cheek, or tried to touch it.
You stood there while he did that?
Just stood there?
It all happened so fast, I say.
So fast, I repeat.
I'm not sure. I just know he tried to do that and was snatching off his coat and trying to throw it over my head, and I ran.
What about the chipping hammer?
He had it out. I'm not sure. Or he got it out. But I know he had it out when he was chasing me into the great room.
Not out at first? He didn't have the chipping hammer out at first, you sure?
She presses me on this point.
I try to remember, to envision it.
No, not at first, I decide. He tried to touch me first with his hand, then net me. Then he pulled out the chipping hammer.
Can you show me what you did next? She asks.
Run?
Yes, run.
Not like that, I say.
I'd have to have the same adrenaline rush, the same panic to run like that.
Kay, walk me through it, please.
I move out of the entrance hall, past the dining room, and back into the great room. Straight ahead is the yellow Jarrah coffee table I discovered at that wonderful shop in Katona, New York.
What was the name?
Antipodes?
The rich blonde wood glows like honey, and I try not to notice the dusting powder all over it, or that somebody left a 7-Eleven coffee cup on it.
The jar of formalin was here on this corner of the table, I tell Berger.
And it was there because...
Because of the tattoo in it. The tattoo I'd removed from the back of the body that we believe is Thomas Chandon.
The defense is going to want to know why you brought human skin to your house, Kay.
Of course.
Everyone's been asking me that.
I feel a rush of annoyance.
The tattoo is important and created many, many questions because we just couldn't figure out what it was. Not only was the body badly decomposed, thus making it very difficult to even see the tattoo, but then it turned out that it was a cover-up tattoo. One tattoo covering up another, and it was crucial especially that we determine what the original tattoo was.
Two gold dots that were covered up with an owl, Berger says.
Every member of the Chandon cartel has two gold dots tattooed on him.
That's what Interpol told me, yes, I say, and by now I have accepted that she and Jay Talley have spent a lot of quality time together.
Brother Thomas was screwing his family, had his own side business, was diverting ships, falsifying bills of lading, running his own guns and drugs. And the theory is the family caught on. He changed his tattoo into an owl and began using aliases, because he knew the family would kill him if they found him.
I recite what I have been told, what Jay told me in Lyon.
Interesting. She touches a finger to her lips, looking around. And it appears the family did kill him. The other son did. The jar of formalin. Why did you bring it home? Tell me again. It wasn't really deliberate. I went to a tattoo parlor in Petersburg to have the tattoo from the body looked at by someone who's an expert, a tattoo artist. I came straight home from there and left the tattoo in my office here. It was just a chance situation that the night he came here... Jean-Baptiste Chandon, yes. The night he came here I had carried the jar in here in the great room and was looking at it while I was doing other things. I set it down. He pushes his way into my house and I run. By now he has the chipping hammer out and has it raised to strike me. It was just a panicked reflex that I see the jar and grab it. I jump over the back of the sofa and unscrew the lid and throw the formalin in his face. A reflex because you know very well how caustic formalin is. You can't smell it every day and not know. It's accepted in my profession that exposure to formalin is a chronic danger, and all of us fear being splashed, I explain, realizing how my story may sound to a special grand jury. Contrived, unbelievable, grotesquely bizarre. Have you ever gotten it in your eyes? Berger asks me. Ever splashed yourself with formalin? No, thank God. So you dashed it in his face. Then what? I ran out of the house. On my way, I grabbed my Glock pistol off the dining room table where I'd left it earlier. I go outside, slip on the icy steps, and fracture my arm. I hold up my cast. And what's he doing? He came out after me. Instantly? It seems like it. Berger moves around to the back of the sofa and stands at the area of antique French oak flooring where formalin has eaten off the finish. She follows the lighter areas of hardwood. The formalin apparently splashed almost to the entrance of the kitchen. This is something I didn't realize until this moment. I only remember his shrieks, his howls of pain as he grabbed at his eyes. Berger stands in the doorway, staring in at my kitchen. I go to her, wondering what has caught her interest. I have to stray off subject and say I don't think I've ever seen a kitchen quite like this, she comments. The kitchen is the heart of my house. Copper pots and pans shine like gold from racks around the huge Thiroad stove that is central to the room and includes two grills, a hot water bath, a griddle, two hot plates, gas tops, a charbroiler, and an oversized burner for the huge pots of soup I love to make. Appliances are stainless steel, including the Sub-Zero refrigerator and freezer. Racks of spices line the walls, and there is a butcher block the size of a twin bed. The oak floor is bare, and there is an upright wine cooler in a corner and a small table by the window that offers a distant view of a rocky bend in the James River. Industrial, Berger mutters as she walks around a kitchen that, yes, I must admit, fills me with pride. Someone who comes in here to work but loves the finer things in life. I've heard you're an amazing cook. I love to cook, I tell her. It gets my mind off everything else. Where do you get your money? She boldly asks. I'm smart with it, I reply coolly, never one to discuss money. I've been lucky with investments over the years. Very lucky. You're a smart businesswoman, Berger says. Try to be. And then when Benton died, he left his Hilton Head condo to me. I pause. I sold it. Couldn't stay there anymore. I pause again. Got 600-something thousand for it. I see. And what's this? She points out the Milano Italian sandwich maker. I explain. Well, when this is all over, you'll have to cook for me sometime, she says rather presumptuously. And rumor has it that you cook Italian. Your specialty. Yes. Mostly Italian. There is no rumor involved. Berger knows more about me than I do. Do you suppose he might have come in here and tried to wash his face in the sink? She then asks. I don't have any idea. All I can tell you is I ran out and fell, and when I looked up he was staggering out the door after me. He came down the steps, still screaming, and dropped to the ground and started rubbing snow in his face, trying to wash the formalin out of his eyes. It's rather oily, isn't it? Hard to wash out? It wouldn't be easy, I reply. You would want copious amounts of warm water. And you didn't offer that to him? Made no effort to help him?
I look at Berger.
Come on, I say. What the hell would you have done?
Anger spikes.
I'm supposed to play doctor after the son of a bitch has just tried to beat my brains out?
It will be asked, Berger matter-of-fact answers me.
But no, I wouldn't have helped him either, and that's off the record. So he's in your front yard.
I left out that I hit the panic alarm when I was running out of the house, I remember.
You grabbed the formalin, you grabbed your gun, you hit the panic alarm. You had pretty damn good presence of mind, didn't you? She comments.
Anyway, you and Sean Dunn are in your front yard. Lucy pulls up and you have to talk her out of shooting him point blank in the head. ATF and all the troops show up. End of story.
I wish it were the end of the story, I say.
The chipping hammer. Berger gets back to that.
Now you figured out what the weapon was because you went to a hardware store and just looked around until you found something that might have made a pattern like the one on Bray's body?
I had more to go on than you might think, I reply.
I knew Bray was struck with something that had two different surfaces. One rather pointed, the other more square. Actual punched-out areas of her skull clearly showed the shape of what struck her, and then the pattern on the mattress that I knew was made when he set down something bloody, which most likely was the weapon. A hammer or pickaxe type of weapon of some sort, but unusual. You look around, you ask people.
And then, of course, when he came to your house, he had this chipping hammer inside his coat or whatever and tried to use it on you.
She says this dispassionately, objectively.
Yes.
So there were two chipping hammers at your house. The one you bought in the hardware store after Bray had already been murdered. And a second hammer, the one he brought with him.
Yes.
I am stunned by what she has just indicated.
Good God, I mutter.
That's right.
I bought the hammer after she was murdered, not before.
I am so confused by what has passed, by the days, by all of it.
What am I thinking? The date on the receipt...
My voice fades. I remember paying cash in the hardware store. $5, something like that. I don't have a receipt, I'm fairly sure, and I feel the blood drain from my face.
Berger has known all along what I have forgotten, that I didn't buy the hammer before Bray was beaten to death, but the day after. But I can't prove it, unless the clerk who waited on me in the hardware store can produce the cash register tape and swear I am the one who bought the chipping hammer, there is no proof.
And now one of them is gone. The chipping hammer you bought is gone, Berger is saying as my mind reels. I tell her I am not privy to what the police found.
But you were there when they were searching your house.
Were you not in your house while the police were? She asks me.
I showed them whatever they wanted to see. I answered their questions. I was there on Saturday and left early that evening, but I can't say I saw everything they did or what they took, nor were they finished when I left. Frankly, I don't even know how long they were in my house or how many times.
I am touched by anger as I explain all this, and Berger senses it.
Christ, I didn't have a chipping hammer when Bray was murdered. I've been confused because I bought it the day her body was found, not the day she died. She was murdered the night before, her body found the next day.
I'm rambling now.
What exactly is a chipping hammer used for? Berger next asks.
And by the way, hate to tell you, but no matter when you say you bought the chipping hammer, Kay, there remains the minor problem that the only one found at your house happened to have Bray's blood on it.
They're used for masonry. There's a lot of slate work in this area, and stonework.
So probably used by roofers?
And the theory is that Sean Dunn found a chipping hammer at the house he had broken into. The place under construction where he was staying?
Bray is relentless.
I believe that's the theory, I reply.
Your house is made of stone and has a slate roof, she says. Did you closely supervise when it was being built? Because you seem the sort who would. A perfectionist.
You're foolish not to supervise if you're building.
I'm just wondering if you might have ever seen a chipping hammer while your house was being built. Maybe at the construction site or in a workman's tool belt?
Not that I recall, but I can't be sure.
And you never owned one prior to your shopping expedition at Pleasant's Hardware on the night of December 17th, 2 weeks ago exactly and almost 24 hours after Bray was murdered?
Not before that night.
No, I never owned one before then. Not that I am aware of, I tell her.
What time was it when you bought the chipping hammer? Berger asks as I hear the deep thunder of Marino's truck parking in front of my house.
Sometime around 7. I don't know exactly.
Maybe between 6:30 and 7 that Friday night, the night of December 17th, I reply.
I'm not thinking clearly now. Berger is wearing me down, and I can't imagine how any lie could stand up to her long. The problem is knowing what is a lie and what isn't, and I'm not convinced she believes me.
And you went home right after the hardware store? She goes on. Tell me what you did the rest of the night.
The doorbell rings. I glance at the iPhone on the wall in the great room and see Marino's face looming in the video screen. Berger has just asked the question. She has just tested the alchemy that I am sure Ryder will use to turn my life to shit. She wants to know my alibi. She wants to know where I was at the exact time Bray was murdered on Thursday night, December 16th.
I'd just come in from Paris that morning, I reply. Ran errands, got home around 6. Later that night, around 10, I drove to MCV to check on Joe, Lucy's former girlfriend, the one who got in the shooting with her in Miami. I wanted to see if I could help out in that situation because the parents were interfering.
My doorbell rings again.
And I wanted to know where Lucy was, and Joe told me Lucy was at a bar in Greenwich Village.
I start walking toward the door.
Berger is staring at me.
In New York.
Lucy was in New York. I came home and called her. She was drunk.
Marino rings the bell again and pounds on the door.
So to answer your question, Miss Berger, I have no alibi for where I was between 6 and maybe 10:30 Thursday night, because I was either in my home or in my car. Alone. Absolutely alone. No one saw me. No one talked to me. I have no witnesses to the fact that where I wasn't between 7:30 and 10:30 was at Diane Bray's house, beating her to death with a goddamn chipping hammer.
I open the door. I can feel Berger's eyes burning into my back.
Marino looks as if he is about to fly apart. I can't tell if he is furious or scared to death. Maybe both.
What the hell? He asks, his eyes going from me to her. What the shit's going on?
I'm sorry for making you stand out in the cold, I tell Marino. Please come in.
Chapter 29.
Marino took so long getting here because he had stopped by the property room at headquarters. I had asked him to pick up the stainless steel key I found in the pocket of Mitch Barbosa's running shorts. Marino tells Berger and me that he rooted around for quite some time inside that small room behind wire mesh, where space-saver shelves are crowded with bar-coded bags, some of which hold items the police took from my house last Saturday.
I have been in the property room before. I can picture it. Portable phones ring from inside those bags. Pagers go off, as unwitting people keep trying to call associates who are either locked up or dead. There are also locked refrigerators for the storage of physical evidence recovery kits and any other evidence that might be perishable, such as the raw chicken I pounded with the chipping hammer.
Now, why did you pound raw chicken with a chipping hammer? Berger wants further clarification on this part of my rather odd story.
To see if the injuries correlated to the ones on Bray's body, I reply.
Well, the chicken's still inside the evidence refrigerator, Marino says. Gotta say, you sure beat the hell out of it.
Describe in detail exactly what you did to the chicken, Berger prods me, as if I am on the witness stand.
I face her and Marino inside my entrance hallway and explain that I placed raw chicken breasts on a cutting board and beat them with every side and edge of the chipping hammer to note the pattern of injuries. The wounds from both the blunt-bladed tip and the pointed tip were identical in configuration and measurement to those on Bray's body, particularly to the punched-out areas in her cartilage and skull, which are excellent for retaining the shape, or tool mark, of whatever penetrated them.
Then I spread out a white pillowcase, I explain. I rolled the coiled handle of the chipping hammer in barbecue sauce.
What kind of barbecue sauce? Berger wants to know, of course.
I recall it was smoky pig barbecue sauce that I had thinned to the consistency of blood, and then I pressed the sauce-coated handle against the cloth to see what that transfer pattern looked like.
I got the same striations that were left in blood on Bray's mattress. The pillowcase with its barbecue sauce imprints, Marino says, were turned into the DNA lab. I remark that this is a waste of time. We don't test for tomatoes. I am not trying to be funny, but am sufficiently frustrated to emit a spark of sarcasm. The only result the DNA lab will get from the pillowcase, I promise, is not human. Marino is pacing the floor. I am screwed, he says, because the chipping hammer I bought and did all these tests with is gone. He couldn't find it. He looked everywhere for it. It isn't listed in the evidence computer. It clearly was never turned into the evidence room, nor was it picked up by forensic technicians and receipted to the labs. It is gone. Gone. And I have no receipt. By now, I am sure of this. I told you from my car phone that I had bought it, I remind him.
Yeah, he says.
He remembers my calling him from my car after I left Pleasant's hardware store sometime between 6:30 and 7. I told him I believed a chipping hammer was what had been used on Bray. I said I had bought one. But, he points out, that doesn't mean I didn't buy such a tool after Bray's murder to fabricate an alibi.
You know, to make it look like you didn't own one or even know what she was killed with until after the fact.
Whose goddamn side are you on? I say to him. You believe this writer bullshit? Jesus, I can't take any more of this.
This isn't about sides, Doc, Marino grimly replies, as Berger looks on.
We are back to there being only one hammer, the one with Bray's blood on it found inside my house, specifically in my great room on the Persian rug, exactly 17.5 inches to the right of the Jarrowwood coffee table. Shandun's hammer. Not my hammer, I keep saying, as I imagine cheap brown paper bags with a voucher number and barcode that represents Scarpetta. Me. Behind wire mesh on space-saver shelves. I lean against the wall inside my entry hallway and feel lightheaded. It is as if I am having an out-of-body experience, looking down on myself after something terrible and final has happened. My undoing. My destruction. I am dead like other people whose brown paper bags end up in that evidence room. I am not dead, but maybe it is worse to be the accused. I hate even to suggest the next stage of my undoing. It is overkill. Marino, I say, try the key in my door. He hesitates, frowning. Then he slips the clear plastic evidence bag out of the inner pocket of his old leather jacket with its balding fleece lining. Cold wind punches into the house as he opens the front door and slides the steel key, easily slides it, into the lock, and clicks the lock, and the deadbolt slides open and shut. The number written on it, I quietly tell Marino and Berger. 233. That's my burglar alarm code.
What?
Berger, for once, is almost speechless. The three of us go into my great room. This time I perch on the cold hearth like Cinderella. Berger and Marino avoid sitting on the ruined couch, but situate themselves near me, looking at me, waiting for any possible explanation. There is but one, and I think it is rather obvious. Police and God knows who else have been in and out of my house since Saturday, I begin. A drawer in the kitchen. In it are keys to everything. My house, my car, my office, file cabinets, whatever. So it's not like someone didn't have easy access to a spare key to my house. And you guys had my burglar alarm code, right? I look at Marino. I mean, you weren't leaving my house unarmed after you left it. And the alarm was on when we came in a little while ago. We need a list of everybody who's been inside this house, Berger grimly decides.
I can tell you everybody I know about, Marino answers, but I haven't been here every time somebody else has, so I can't say I know who everybody is.
I sigh and lean my back against the fireplace. I start naming cops I saw with my own eyes, including Jay Talley, including Marino. And Ryder's been in here, I add. As have I. Berger replies, but I certainly didn't let myself in. I had no idea what your code is. Who let you in? I ask. Her answer is to look at Marino. It bothers me that Marino never told me he was Berger's tour guide. It is irrational for me to feel stung. After all, who better than Marino? Who do I trust more than him? Marino is visibly agitated. He gets up and strolls through the doorway leading into my kitchen. I hear him open the drawer where I keep the keys. Then he opens the refrigerator. "Well, I was with you when you found that key in Mitch Barbosa's pocket," Berger starts to think out loud. "You couldn't have put it there, couldn't have planted it," she is working this out, "because you weren't at the scene, and you didn't touch the body unwitnessed. I mean, Marino and I were right there when you unzipped the pouch," she blows out in frustration. "And Marino?" "He wouldn't," I cut her off with a weary wave of my hand. "No way. And based on his account of the crime scene, he never saw Barbosa's body. It was already being loaded into the ambulance when he pulled up on Mosby Court. So either one of the cops at the scene did it. Or more likely," I finish her thought, "the key was placed in Barbosa's pocket when he was killed. At the crime scene. Not where he was dumped." Marino walks in drinking a bottle of Spaten beer that Lucy must have bought. I don't remember buying it. Nothing about my house seems to belong to me any more, and Anna's story comes to mind. I am beginning to understand the way she must have felt when Nazis occupied her family home. I realize suddenly that people can be pushed beyond anger, beyond tears, beyond protest, beyond even grief. Finally, you just sink into a dark mire of acceptance. What is, and what was past. "I can't live here anymore," I tell Berger and Marino. "You got that right," Marino fires back, in the aggressive, angry tone he seems to wear like his own skin these days. "Look," I say to him, "don't bark at me any more, Marino. We're all angry, frustrated, worn out. I don't understand what's happening, but it's clear someone connected to us is also involved in the murder of these two recent victims, these men who were tortured. And I guess whoever planted my key on Barbosa's body wants to either implicate me in those crimes as well, or more likely is sending me a warning." "I think it's a warning," Marino says. "And where's Rocky these days?" I almost ask him. "Your dear son Rocky," Berger says it for me. Marino takes a slug of beer and wipes his mouth with the back of his hand. He doesn't respond. Berger glances at her watch and looks up at us. "Well," she says, "Merry Christmas, I guess." Chapter 30. Anna's house is dark and still when I come in at nearly 3 a.m. She has thoughtfully left on a light in the hallway and one in the kitchen near a crystal tumbler and the bottle of Glenmorangie just in case I need a sedative. At this hour I decline. A part of me wishes Anna were awake. I'm halfway tempted to rattle around in hopes she will wander in and sit down with me. I have become oddly addicted to our sessions, even if I am now supposed to wish they had never taken place. I make my way to the guest wing and start thinking about transference, and wonder if I am experiencing this with Anna. Or maybe I just feel lonely and gloomy because it is Christmas, and I am wide awake and frazzled in someone else's house after investigating violent death all day, including one I am accused of committing. Anna has left a note on my bed. I pick up the elegant, creamy envelope and can tell by its weight and thickness that whatever she has written is lengthy. I leave my clothes in a pile on the bathroom floor and imagine the ugliness that must linger in their very fabrics because of where I have been and what I have done the past 20 hours. I do not realize until I am out of the shower that the clothes carry with them the dirty fire smell of the motel room. Now I ball them up in a towel so I can forget about them until they can go to the dry cleaner. I wear one of Anna's thick robes to bed and am edgy as I pick up the letter again. I open it and unfold 6 stiff pages of watermarked engraved stationery. I begin to read, willing myself not to go too fast. Anna is deliberate and wants me to take in every word because she does not waste words. Dearest K, as a child of the war, I learned that truth is not always what is right or good or best. If the SS came to your door and asked if you had Jews inside, you did not tell the truth if you were hiding Jews. When members of the Totenkopf SS occupied my family home in Austria, I could not tell the truth about how much I hated them. When the SS commander of Mauthausen came into my bed so many nights and asked me if I enjoyed what he did to me, I did not tell the truth. He would tell vile jokes and hiss in my ear, imitating the sound of the Jews being gassed, and I laughed because I was afraid. He would get very drunk sometimes when he came back from the camp, and once he bragged he had killed a 12-year-old village boy in nearby Langenstein during an SS hunting raid. Later I learned this was not so, that the Leitsteller, chief of Staatspolizei in Linz, was the one who shot the boy. But I believed what I was told at the time, and my fear was indescribable. I, too, was a civilian child. No one was safe. In 1945 that same commander died in Gusen, and his body was displayed to the public for days. I saw it and spat. That was the truth about how I felt, a truth I could not tell earlier. Truth is relative, then. It is about timing. It is about what is safe. Truth is the luxury of the privileged, of people who have plenty of food and are not forced to hide because they are Jews. Truth can destroy, and therefore it is not always wise or even healthy to be truthful. A strange thing for a psychiatrist to admit, yes? I give you this lesson for a reason, Kay. After you read my letter, you must destroy it, and never admit it existed. I know you well. Such a small covert act will be hard for you. If you are asked, you must say nothing about what I am telling you here. My life in this country would be ruined if it was known that my family gave food and shelter to the SS, no matter that our hearts were not in it. It was to survive. I also think you would be greatly harmed if people should know that your best friend is a Nazi sympathizer, as I am certain I would be called. And, oh, what a terrible thing to be called, especially when one hates them as I do. I am a Jew. My father was a prescient man and very aware of what Hitler intended to do. In the late 30s, my father used his banking and political connections and wealth to secure entire new identities for us. He changed our name to Zena and moved us from Poland to Austria when I was too young to be aware of much. So you might say that I have lived a lie since I can remember. Perhaps this helps you understand why I do not want to be interrogated in a legal proceeding, and why I will avoid this if I can. So, Kay, the real reason for this long letter is not to tell my story. At last, I talk to you about Benton. I am quite certain you do not know that for a while he was my patient. About 3 years ago he came to see me in my office. He was depressed and had many work-related difficulties that he could not speak of to anyone, including you. He said that throughout his career with the FBI he had seen the worst of the worst, the most aberrant acts imaginable, and although he had been haunted by them and suffered in many ways because of this exposure to what he called evil, he had never felt truly afraid. Most of those bad people were not interested in him, he said. They meant him no personal harm, and in fact enjoyed the attention he paid to them when he interviewed them in prison. As for the many cases he helped police solve, again, he was in no personal danger. Serial rapists and killers were not interested in him. But then strange things began to happen to him some months before he came to see me. I wish I could remember better, Kay, but there were odd events. Phone calls. Hang-ups that could not be traced because they were made by satellite. I guess he meant cell phones. He got crank mail that made very terrible references to you. There were threats made towards you. Again, untraceable. It was clear to Benton that whoever was writing the letters knew something about both of you personally. Of course he was very suspicious of Carrie Grethen. He kept saying, "We haven't heard the last from that woman." But at the time, he did not see how she could be making the calls and sending the mail because she was still locked up in New York, in Kirby. I will sum up 6 months of conversations with Benton by saying he had a very strong premonition that his death was imminent. He suffered subsequent depression, anxiety, paranoia, and began to struggle with alcohol. He said he hid bouts of heavy drinking from you, and that his problems were causing a deterioration in his relationship with you. As I listened to some of what you told me during our talks, Kay, I can see that his behavior at home did change. Now perhaps you understand some of the reasons why. I wanted to put Benton on a mild antidepressant, but he would not let me. He worried constantly about what would happen to you and Lucy if something happened to him. He wept about it openly in my office. It was I who suggested he write the letter that Senator Lord delivered to you several weeks ago. I said to Benton, "Imagine you are dead and have one last chance to say something to Kay." So he did. He said to you the words you read in his letter. During our sessions, I suggested to him repeatedly that perhaps he knew more about who was harassing him, and perhaps denial was preventing him from facing the truth. He hesitated. I remember so well I had a feeling he possessed information he could not or would not say. Now I am beginning to think I might know. I have reached the conclusion that what happened to Benton several years ago and what is now happening to you are connected to Marino's mafia son. Rocky is involved with very powerful criminal people, and he hates his father. He would hate everyone who matters to his father. Can it be a coincidence that Benton got threatening letters and was murdered, and then this terrible killer Sean Dunn ends up in Richmond, and now Marino's terrible son is Sean Dunn's lawyer? Is this tortuous road not winding at last to some dreadful conclusion that is meant to bring down everyone good in Marino's life? In my office, Benton often referred to a clip file. In it, he kept all the strange, menacing letters and other records of communications and incidents that he had begun to receive. For months, I thought he was saying tip file, as in police tips. But one day I made mention of his tip file, and he corrected me and said the file was actually his TLP file, which he pronounced clip. I next asked what TLP stood for, and he said the last precinct. I asked him what he meant by that, and his eyes filled with tears. His exact words to me were this: "The last precinct is where I will end up, Anna. It is where I'll end up." You cannot imagine my feeling when Lucy mentioned that this is also the name for the investigative consulting company that she has now gone to work for in New York. When I was so upset last night, it was not simply over the subpoena delivered to my house. What happened was the following. I got the subpoena. I called Lucy because I thought she should know what was happening to you. She said her new boss, Tian McGovern, was in town and mentioned the last precinct. I was shocked. I still am shocked, and do not understand what all this means. Does Lucy perhaps know about Benton's file? Again, can this be coincidence, Kay? Did she just happen to think up the same name that Benton called his secret file? Can all these connections be coincidences? Now there is something called the Last Precinct, and it is located in New York, and Lucy is moving to New York. The trial of Sean Dunn has moved to New York because he killed in New York 2 years ago, while Carrie Grethen was still incarcerated in New York, and Carrie's former murderous partner Temple Galt was killed by you in New York, and Marino began his police career in New York, and Rocky lives in New York. Let me close by telling you I feel so badly over any hand I might have in making your current situation worse, although you can be sure I intend to say nothing that can be twisted. Never. I am too old for this. Tomorrow, on Christmas Day, I will leave for my house in Hilton Head, where I will stay until it is all right to return to Richmond. I do this for several reasons. I do not intend to make it easy for Buford or anyone else to get to me. Most important, you need some place to stay. Do not go back to your house, Kay. Your devoted friend, Anna. I read and reread. I feel sick as I imagine Anna growing up in the poisonous air of Malthausen and knowing what went on there. I feel the deepest sorrow that all her life she has listened to references to Jews and bad jokes about Jews and learned more of the atrocities committed against Jews, all the while knowing she is a Jew. No matter how she rationalizes it, What her father did was cowardly and wrong. I suspect he also knew Anna was being raped by the SS commander he wined and dined, and Anna's father did nothing about that either. Not one thing. I realize it is now almost 5 o'clock in the morning. My eyelids are heavy, my nerves buzzing. There is no point in trying to sleep. I get up and go into the kitchen to make coffee. For a while I sit before the dark window looking out toward a river I can't see and contemplate everything Anna has revealed to me. So much about Benton's last years now makes sense. I think of days when he claimed to have a tension headache, and I thought he looked hungover, and now I suspect he probably was. He was increasingly depressed and distant and frustrated. In a way, I understand his not telling me about the letters, the phone calls, the clip file, as he referred to it. But I don't agree with him. He should have told me. I have no recollection of having come across such a file when I was going through his belongings after his death. But then there is so much I don't remember about that time. It was as if I were living under the earth, moving ever so heavily and slowly, and unable to see where I was going or where I had been. After Benton's death, Anna helped me sort through his personal effects. She cleaned out his closets and went through his drawers while I was in and out of rooms like a crazed insect, helping one minute, ranting and weeping the next. I wonder if she came across that file. I know I must find it, if it still exists. The first morning light is a hint of deep blue as I fix coffee for Anna and carry it back to her bedroom. I listen outside her door to see if I hear any sign of her being awake. All is still. I quietly open her door and carry her coffee in. I set it down on the oval table by her bed. Anna likes nightlights. Her suite is lit up like a runway, lights inserted in almost every receptacle. When I first became aware of this, I thought it odd. Now I begin to understand. Perhaps she associates utter darkness with being alone and terrified in her bedroom, waiting for a drunken, stinking Nazi to come in and overpower her young body. No wonder she has spent her life dealing with damaged people. She understands damaged people. She is as much a student of her past tragedies as she has said I am of mine. "Anna," I whisper. I see her stir. "Anna, it's me. I've brought you coffee." She sits up with a start, squinting, her white hair in her face and sticking up in places. "Merry Christmas," I start to say. I tell her happy holidays instead. "All these years I celebrate Christmas while I am secretly Jewish." She reaches for her coffee. "I am not known for a sweet disposition early in the morning," she says. I squeeze her hand, and in the dark she seems suddenly so old and delicate. "I read your letter. I'm not sure what to say, but I can't destroy it, and we must talk about it," I tell her. For an instant she pauses. I think I catch relief in her silence. Then she gets stubborn again and waves me off, as if by a mere gesture she can dismiss her entire history and what she has told me about my own life. Nightlights cast exaggerated deep shadows of Biedermeier furniture and antique lamps and oil paintings in her large, gorgeous bedroom. Thick silk draperies are drawn. "I probably should not have written any of that to you," she says firmly. "I wish you'd written it to me sooner, Anna." She sips her coffee and pulls the covers up to her shoulders. "What happened to you as a child isn't your fault," I say to her. "The choices were made by your father, not you. He protected you in one way and didn't protect you at all. Maybe there was no choice." She shakes her head. "You do not know. You cannot know." I am not about to argue with that. "There are no monsters to compare with them. My family had no choice. My father drank a lot of schnapps. He was drunk most of the time on schnapps, and they would get drunk with him. To this day I cannot smell schnapps." She clutches the coffee mug in both hands. "They all got drunk. It did not matter. When Reich Minister Speer and his entourage visited installations at Gusen and Ebensee, they came to our Schloss, oh yes, our quaint little castle. My parents had this sumptuous banquet with musicians from Vienna, and the finest champagne and food, and everyone was drunk. I remember I hid in my bedroom, so afraid of who would come next. I hid under the bed all night, and several times there were footsteps in my room, and once someone yanked the covers back and swore. I stayed on the floor under the bed all night, dreaming of the music, and of one young man who made such sweetness flow from his violin. He looked at me often and made me blush, and as I hid under my bed later that night, I thought of him. No one who made such beauty could be unkind. All night I thought of him. "The violinist from Vienna?" I asked. "The one you later..." "No, no," Anna shakes her head in the shadows. "This was many years before Rudy. But I think it is when I fell in love with Rudy in advance, having never met him. I saw the musicians in their black cutaways and was mesmerized by the magic they made, and I wanted them to steal me from the horror. I imagined myself soaring on their notes into a pure place. For a moment, I was returned to Austria before the quarry and the crematorium, when life was simple, the people decent and fun, and had perfect gardens and such pride in their homes. On sunny spring days, we would hang our goose-down duvets out windows to be scrubbed by the sweetest air I have ever breathed. And we would play in rolling fields of grass that seemed to lead right up to the sky, while Father would hunt in the woods for boar and Mother would sew and bake." She pauses, her face touched by sweet sadness. "That a string quartet could transform the most dreadful of nights. And then later my magical thinking carries me into the arms of a man with a violin, an American, and I'm here. I am here. I escaped. But I have never escaped, Kay."
Dawn begins to light up the drapes and turn them the color of honey. I tell Anna I am glad she is here. I thank her for talking to Benton and for finally letting me know. In some ways, the picture is more complete because of what I now understand. In some ways, it isn't. I can't sharply outline the progression of moods and changes that preceded Benton's murder, but I do know that about the time he was seeing Anna, Carrie Grethen was looking for a new partner to replace Temple Galt. Carrie had worked in computers earlier in her life. She was brilliant and incredibly manipulative, and talked her way into gaining access to a computer at the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital, Kirby. This was how she cast her web back out into the world. She linked up with a new partner, another psychopathic killer named Newton Joyce. She did this through the Internet, and he helped her escape from Kirby. "Perhaps she met certain other people through the Internet, too," Anna suggests. "Marino's son, Rocky?" I say. "I am thinking it." "Anna, do you have any idea what happened to Benton's file? The clip file, as he called it?"
"I have never seen it."
She sits up straighter, deciding it is time to get out of bed, and the covers settle around her waist. Her bare arms look pitifully thin and wrinkled, as if someone has let the air out of them. Her bosom sags low and loose beneath dark silk.
"When I helped you sort through his clothing and other personal belongings, I did not see a file, but I did not touch his office."
"I remember so little."
"No."
She pulls back the covers and lowers her feet to the floor.
"I would not. That was not something I would go into. His professional files."
She is up now and slips on a robe. "I just assumed you would have gone through those." She looks at me.
"You have, yes? What about his office at Quantico? He had already retired, so I suppose he had cleaned that out already?"
"That was cleaned out, yes." We walk down the hallway toward the kitchen. Case files would have stayed there. Unlike some of his compatriots who retire from the FBI, Benton didn't believe cases he worked belonged to him, I add ruefully. So I know he didn't take any case files away from Quantico when he retired. What I don't know is if he would have left the clip file with the Bureau. If so, I'll never see it.
"That was his file," Anna points out. "Correspondence to him. When he spoke about it to me, he never referred to what was happening to him as Bureau business. He seemed to take the threats, the crank calls, as something personal, and I am not aware that he ever shared these things with other agents. He was so paranoid, mostly because some of the threats involved you. I was led to believe I am the only person he told. I know this. I said to him many times that I believed he should tell the FBI.
She shook her head. He would not, she says again.
I empty the coffee filter into the trash and feel a spike of old resentment. Benton kept so much from me.
A shame, I reply.
Maybe if he'd told some of the other agents, none of this would have happened.
Would you like more coffee?
I am reminded that I did not go to bed last night.
I guess I'd better, I reply.
Some Viennese coffee, Anna decides, opening the refrigerator and picking through bags of coffee. Since I am feeling nostalgic for Austria this morning.
She says this with a hint of sarcasm, as if she is silently berating herself for divulging details of her past. She pours beans into the grinder, and the kitchen is filled briefly with noise.
Benton got disillusioned with the Bureau in the end, I think out loud. I'm not sure he trusted people around him anymore. Competitiveness. He was the unit chief and knew everybody was going to fight over his job the minute he even mentioned he was ready to retire. Knowing him, he handled his problems in total isolation, the same way he worked his cases. If nothing else, Benton was a master of discretion. I am running through every possibility. Where would Benton have kept the file? Where might it be? He had his own room in my house where he stored his belongings and plugged in his laptop. He had file drawers. But I have been through those and never saw anything even similar to what Anna has described. Then I think of something else. When Benton was murdered in Philadelphia, he was checked into a hotel. Several bags of his personal effects were returned to me, including his briefcase, which I opened. I went through it just as the police had. I know I didn't see anything like this clip file, but if it is true Benton was suspicious that Carrie Grethin might have had something to do with the crank calls and notes he was getting, might he not have carried the clip file with him when he was working new cases possibly connected to her? Wouldn't he have brought the file to Philadelphia? I go to the phone and call Marino.
Merry Christmas, I say. It's me.
What? He blurts out, half asleep.
Oh, shit. What time is it?
A few minutes past 7.
7?
Groan.
Hell, Santa ain't even come yet. What you calling me so early for?
Marino, this is important. When the police went through Benton's personal effects in the hotel room in Philadelphia, did you go through